So I thought this would be a great opportunity to talk a little bit about Parashat Parah, and particularly the way that Parashat Parah comes right smack bang in the other P period, which of course is the post-Purim pre-Pesach Parah. So it's like, there's really five P's in a row over here, and they're clearly fundamentally related. I tried saying a nice word about you. That's why you... Oh, wow. That's special. Let's see what his father's outside. Quite close. It's interesting, in my mother's effects, I found a picture from that Technion thing.
Oh, yeah?
No, that was happening. All right. Yeah. And the truth is that the transition from Purim to Pesach is quite complex. I mean, we know that Chazal tell us that there's an inyan of being mismach geula legula. So obviously, if we use that as a determination of when it is that we're supposed to actually place Purim, it's got to mean that there's a fundamental connection between the geulot. And yet, the major difference, of course, is how in the world we're supposed to come and learn and achieve a deeper sense of chirut and geula from a period in which, as the Gemara says, one of the reasons that we don't say Halel on Purim is because it says Halel Avdei Hashem. And coming out of Purim, we're still Avdei Achashverosh. So when we came out of Mitzrayim, there was a sense of true Geula. When we came out of Purim, there was a sense of something missing, and yet there's no question that Purim is really the ultimate Geula. It's the future Geula. It's the one thing that is never going to be batel. It turns out to be more. It's Ikar. And Yitziat Mitzrayim turns out to be Tafel in terms of the story of history, which is remarkable. And it's clear that Chazal have been koveya, the transition between the two periods, by the instrument of the Arba Parshiot. It's a very strange phenomenon that we should have a preparatory series of parashot that come before Pesach and that actually join Purim to Pesach, the final two parashiot. What I think is inarguable in terms of how it is that it's clear that they have to be interrelated, Torah and Chodesh, as the interrelationship of Purim to Pesach is absolutely astonishing. One of the interesting differences between Mitzrayim and Purim is that when it comes to Yitziat Mitzrayim, we're left with a mitzvah, which is a lo ta'aseh, kasher eitev et Mitzrayim ayom, you're not allowed to go back to Eretz Mitzrayim. When it comes to Purim, not only is there no issue of not going back, it ends up being a mitzvah to be in Bavel, but the strange thing is that we come back and we build into the Beit HaMikdash a sha'ar. And on the top of the Shar is a picture of Shushan HaBira. So that Shar is called Shar Shushan, for obvious reasons. But what was the Shar Shushan for? Says the Mishnah, the Shar Shushan is where the Kohen Haoseh Tapara would go out, of course. So we go directly from Shushan, from Purim, into the actual Asiyat Taparat. If somebody thinks it's coincidental that we would go from Purim through Parashat Parah to Pesach, I don't know. That's like really living in this Nistan. So the problem, of course, is that Parashat Parah doesn't make a heck of a lot of sense. I mean, that's the one of the major problems with it. And it's viewed as chok in the ultimate sense. It's pure chok. It's the only time that the Torah really defines something. Zot chukat Torah. This is the way to look at chok. And if that's the case, then the point of chok, it's certainly a point of ultimate chok, is that it's distinguished from our normal way of looking at things the same way that a chok of science is distinguished. It's not meant to make any sense, description of the way things are. That's what chok means. So somebody's going to tell you, this is why the speed of light is X in a vacuum. There's no why. That's the description of the way the universe is in terms of what time consists of. That's what is. That's ultimate chok. When you're dealing with ultimate chok, fundamental values, you don't expect them to make particularly good sense. You're talking about chok in terms of the Torah. it's not coincidental that the closer we get to fundamental chok, the less sense it's going to make. And para is upheld as the one thing that is amartiach kamay rechokam imeni. Shlomo HaMelech himself figured, come to understand all of the mitzvot HaTorah, comes to para, throws up his hands, it's rechokam imeni. And yet, the point of Yetziat Mitzrayim, obviously, is to achieve exactly the transition from Halalu Avdei Hashem, from being Avdei Paro. And that's why we need it to be Avadim. Avadim means that you're going to work, you're going to achieve something, you're going to build something. Instead of building something for someone else, build something for reality. That's the Halalu Avdei Hashem. In order to build, in order to achieve, you have to have a sense of what you're building. You have to have a sense of what you're achieving. To take a look at the mitzvot HaTorah, the way Islam looks at the chukot, kivayachol, of their religion, that the whole point is the Islam, per se, is the giving in and being machnia yourself. Per se, it may be that that's a very necessary part of it's not being a self-involved and solipsistic exercise, but obviously the point of avodah is that you are achieving something, not that the idea of avodat perach, you're building cities that are going to be swallowed up in the earth. That's not avodah. That's the opposite of avodah. So how in the world are we supposed to take the aspect of true avodah, which has to be about our real interrelationship with the universe? You can't do anything with the universe if it doesn't make sense. And if that's the case, to say that the nature of para, which is like really, really far out, is central to our achieving the geula, which leads us to avodah, is difficult to understand. It doesn't seem to be any true connection of the Torah element to the avodah element. The Torah element is always that which gives us a structure, gives us a context to be able to make the avodah meaningful and real. And there's no question that the extent of the understandability, the extent at which the fundamental nature of chok is actually part of the way that we approach it, is brought out by the Rambam, who talks about the way in which we must deal with chok, and that we absolutely... He speaks for a very long time about this, both in the Hilchot Milah and the Hilchot Tumura. And he speaks about the way in which a person has to view chok with exactly the same sense of meaningfulness and ultimately ta'am that he does mishpat. And that's something shelo yimtza bo ta'am, if you don't find any sense in it, assign sense to it. Doesn't seem to make sense. Man, you assign sense to something that doesn't have sense. Of course, sense means sensibility, not sense in the sense of rationality, but in the literal sense. Ta'am means taste. But it has to be tasteful enough. It has to be something at least that you could experience on some... Ah, he always does this. Works in a way, and then I can't possibly continue. Hello, Ellie. So... the question, of course, is, I mean, if that's the case, and we're talking about something that is so arcane, and yet the Rambam actually speaks about para specifically, because he has a totally different approach to the Medrash, which would say, Amartiach kamadir chokami many, means that it's the one thing that Shlomo HaMelech had no access to at all. And he says, no, that's not the case. Actually, Shlomo HaMelech knew Rov Ta'amei Kol Chukei HaTorah, including Para Aduma. There's to be no other way of actually knowing Torah at all. And if that's the case, it means that Chok, on the level of fundamental understanding, and Para, as an expression of the nature of Avodah, are really deeply related. In other words, I've got to be able to approach this far-reaching Avodah. And it's because of that the Gemara actually learns out Dinim of Chatat, which is Kachei Mizbeach, from Parat Chatat, which is Kachei Berek Abayit, where it shouldn't be related. And yet the Torah puts them together. The reason that we call Para Zot Chukat HaTorah, you're not going to come any closer, will you? So I'm wearing reading glasses, so I can't even have the joy of seeing you. Okay, but I know who it is, so that's something. So Zod Chukat HaTorah is because, as the Gemara says, it's paradoxical. It's not simply that it doesn't make sense. No sense. It makes anti-sense. And that the halachot, once you attempt to, and it's a machloket in the Gemara, which particular element is considered to be paradoxical. But clearly the application of para is viewed as paradoxical. And that's what Shlomo HaMelech was referring to, says the Gemara, particularly the paradoxical element of the way in which the Tuma and Tyra expresses itself in terms of para. And yet this was something that provides such a basis to Avoda that it's even, as the Pasuk tells us, that the Goyim, when they see Klal Yisrael, they end up saying, Kimi Goy Gadol Hashelo Chukim Umishpatim Sadikim, which means, as Rashi says, how can you have Chok and Mishpat, which are Tzadikim? Tzadikim, he says, means Hegunim. Hegunim means reasonable, acceptable, which is crazy. I mean, that's the whole point is, Rashi says, Chok is like the Paraduma, which the Umot Olam laugh at and says is ridiculous. And yet, clearly, in context of the formation of society as a whole, what it is that they see of Goy Gadol, it has to be Hagun. But clearly, it's playing a role in actually forming and contextualizing the nature of Aveda. Now, that means that our need to understand this is the need to actually not simply accept, but to actually be capable of truly relating the nature of Torah to Aveda. And that's exactly where we are. I mean, we just finished the conclusion of Har Sinai. We finished the building of a Mishkan, which ends with the promise, the Noadity, which was Noad for in the first place. This is what it was for. We open up this week in the parasha with the giving over of the Torah, Vayikra Moshe, and now everything is given over in the Omoy, that's for Noadity L'Hashem. But obviously there's the other function, which is Mizbeach, which is Avodah, which is the place that we're created from. That's where we're up to. And what's amazing is that for some reason Paraduma shows up in both places very, very deeply. Because immediately prior to Kabbalat HaTorah, we come to Mara. And there it says, Sham Sam Lo Chok U'Mishpat. And Chazal tells us that was para. So as an introduction to Torah, we needed to have para. As an introduction to the beginning of Avodah, so on Shmini B'Miluim, the day of the actual first full, the Avodah in which Moshe Rabbeinu gives over the Avodah to Aharon HaKohen. So Shmini B'Miluim, it says Shmone Parshiot. There were 8 parashiot specifically that were given over on that day. And of course, the conclusion of those parashiot was para. So that means both in terms of the introduction to Torah itself and the introduction to Avodah itself, that which combines the two is this most unlikely thing in the world, which is para aduma. The centrality of its role in that process, by the way, is brought out by the fact that anybody who's learned Masechet Yomah is very aware of the complete similarity of Para Aduma with Yom HaKippurim. Of course, Para Aduma is ultimate kapara, kaparat chatat. But the point is that the Shivat Yamim, which begins the Masechet, is merumez in the Torah exactly in the Lashon of the Pasuk, the way that you did B'Yom HaZeh, this is the way that you have to do. Do when? Says the Gemara, do in terms of Para, whenever you make a Para. And of course, that itself, that Yom Kippur itself, is fundamentally related in every possible manner. The Yom Kippurim is a reconstruction of Shmini B'Miluim, and we do Achrei Mot Shnei B'nei Aharon. It's exactly that which we're trying to recreate. It's the nature of true Kapara, and it seems similar in many ways to this whole business of just going off planet, in a sense, in which things cease to make experiential sense and rational sense. So that means all three periods in which we have any real dealing with the problems of Kabbalat HaTorah, Har Sinai, Purim, and the actual Yom HaKippurim, when we got the second Luchot, are all weirdly Parah-related. The last thing that you would have thought. Now, of course, the paradoxical element of Parah is merumas in the word Parah. Parah means paradox. Parah, to say in Hebrew as well as in Greek, paradox is similar to para, which is parochet. Parochet is one side to the other, it's that which divides. Paradox is exactly the same idea, in which you have a breakdown of some dualistic element in which one side of the equation and the other side of the equation seem to be contradictory. And the internal contradictions that the Gemara points out is fundamental to why we deal with para as chok and paradox. That's really its most important nekuda. And the truth is, if we take a look at, in general, human development, understanding, fascinatingly, exactly as the Torah is giving us para here, we know that most important developments in mathematics and in science are essentially an outgrowth of paradox. In other words, you come to paradox, so starting from Zeno's paradox, which ultimately, hundreds of years later, gives birth to calculus, because, I mean, there's got to be some way that Achilles manages to take over the tortoise, you know, otherwise you're in big trouble. And starting from there, to the paradoxes of the nature of life, light, which gives us quantum mechanics, it's always, really, elements of paradox that are going to give birth to the new. And the problem is that paradox seems to be the least relevant to experience of any aspect, both of science and of Torah. I mean, in a sense, the areas of human discovery that are furthest from our sense of being able to relate to experientially are those things that are outgrowths of paradox. They don't talk to us about the experience of being ourselves. They may talk about a structure, they may give us insights into the Torah element, so to speak, either of science or of Torah itself, which in the end, of course, are the same. But as far as what it means to be us, we feel very left out, specifically because of the nature of paradox. In other words, it's all very nice. You take a look at Zeno and you think to yourself, all right, I don't know what kind of weirdos are going to sit around questioning, you know, how he could catch up or how he could pass, but you got to be crazy when I'm going to waste my time on this, you know. I mean, it's obviously, you just run faster than the turtle, you know, it should be fine. And that's really the way we like to think about, you know, yeah, Torah and mitzvahs and so on, paradox, you know, whatever. Somehow it makes sense. Modern people have very little patience. It's all whatever when it comes to paradox. To get into issues that are irrelevant to experience, and that should be the transition to Aveda, which obviously has to be experience. I mean, the Rambam's explanation of the entire nature of Avodat HaKorbanot is that it's only experience. The entire issue has to do with the human experience of Aveda, of the mammalian need for Aveda, of the sensitivity of the way in which we develop, in which we evolved. So we have to have that connection. So you're going to tell me, but the ultimate Aveda is to feel no connection at all, to be completely abstract. I mean, it makes no sense. It simply makes no sense. And obviously it cannot be coincidental that we're going to discover, you know, specifically in paradox, we're going to discover real Torah and real Avodah, when that's exactly what happens in general in the world, that we discover how to look at the world correctly when we do that. But, I mean, it's got to be that's teaching us that something is fundamentally wrong with our thinking. That's what paradox is. In other words, if it doesn't make real sense when you look at it, then something is wrong with the way you are perceiving something about movement, something about light, something about, most fundamentally, the dualistic way that you set up the problem. It's got to be, because it's given this dualistic reality, this can't exist. So there's got to be some way of getting beyond that. And each time getting beyond that gives you a different sense of integration of the world, and sometimes even more. And obviously, there's a hint to all of this in Purim itself, because you come out of Purim with very, very much the same exact dualistic problem in the nature of avoda that you face in Paraduma, as we'll see. And that is, the main message of Purim doesn't make any sense. In other words, the main message of Mordechai telling Esther, the Revach Hatzalah Yamod LaYudim Mimakom Acher, and to couple that in one sentence with Atu Beit Avich Tovedu, is insane. But on a rational level, if you're telling me, Esther, it makes no difference to us whatsoever whether you go in and speak to the Melech. Because anyway, Revach Hatzalah Yamod LaYudim Mimakom Acher. And the only thing is that if you don't do it, you're screwed, totally. Because this is what your whole life is for. Mi odeim leit kazoti gata malchut, and so on. I mean, yes, it talks to me about the profound meaning. I understand all of the solutions to the probability issues, to the way in which one can say that the makom acher is me if I'm the one who acts on it. But if you're talking about a rational description of the contextual element, which Purim is all about, but it's Purim is Netzach. You're talking about a rational structure that is supposed to provide for real asiya at this moment. Something is missing. Certainly the dualistic experience that we have of the thing. We are motivated to act, and we feel the meaning of our action always in some type of mechanistic fashion. There's got to be some point, even as the Gemara Megillah questions, what was the point of Esther's inviting? Why did she invite him to the party? Okay, you can have 10 different reasons, as the Gemara offers. And you can have Eliyahu HaNavi walking in and saying to the question of, so which one was it? All of the above. That's all very nice, but it still does boil down to some experiential point of needing to achieve an end. That achievement of the end is on some level mechanistic. So that means there's some interrelationship between the probability effect of Purim is poor and the actual mechanics of what it is you go about doing. The integration of those two issues is by no means obvious, but on the surface, there is certainly a contradiction. And it's a contradiction, by the way, that the Mishnah in Avot points out with the words Hakol Tzafui V'Harashut Netuna, which the Rambam views as being absolutely fundamental to understanding the nature of Avodah. This is as in Hilchot Teshuvah, in a way that we've pointed out many times, in a way that seems to elude the Ravid, because when he comes to explain the question of Yidiyan Bechira, he introduces it with a long introduction of this is a problem. And then when he comes to give you the answer, he says, well, you should know that it's a very long answer. But what you need to know is, Sarikha Talidani, this is what you need to know. And the Ravid says, well, smart people don't ask questions that they can't answer, you know. So, but it's clear, obviously, what the Rambam is saying is, whatever the issues are, there is one thing you absolutely must know. You've got to know the paradox, and you've got to know the direction in which the solution lies. So in other words, he is essentially telling you, you cannot avoid the paradoxical issue. It's only that paradox that makes it possible for you to live in a world that will make it an option for you to exercise, in the case of Hilchot Teshuvah, Bechira, here we're talking about Avodah. Of course, to him, the definition of all Avodah is an outgrowth of Hilchot Teshuvah, as we see in the end. Ha'oved mi'ahava doesn't have a concept of Teshuvah mi'ahava, only of Avodah mi'ahava. So, yes, Yediyah Bechira, by the way, it's curious that Pesach itself, of course, is the time when this comes up, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu literally sets up the whole thing in this crazy way in which we're talking about giving humans freedom through depriving Paro of his freedom, which makes no sense. I mean, this is one of the questions that the Rambam asks. How, if I'm claiming that there is such a thing as freedom, and that's the whole point of Yitzhak Mitzrayim, and that freedom is innate to the human condition. It's not something that is up for grabs that HaKadosh Baruch Hu can interfere in. And he goes all the way back to Gan Eden in this, right? Pen Yishlach Yado. I can't stop him from Pen Yishlach Yado. Well, then, Esra Mamza, what are you going to do about Paro? Fine. Whatever his explanation is. But it certainly is not a coincidence. We're coming to talk about Chirut, that we must deal with the issues of the paradoxical problems of Yideh and Bechira, not only in Purim, but even in the Kashyut Lev of the story of Pesach itself. That's weird. And the way to it is clearly the way through paradox, or the way through Pura. And I think the truth is that the deepest need for Pura at this point is for the underlying problems that touch upon the nature of Torah itself. In other words, when we're talking about Kapara, we're talking about a fundamental level of Kapara here, which is completely different, as the Medrash points out. And we have it Emor la Kohanim, but Moshe Rabbeinu tells HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you know, you're telling me what to do about all these different types of Tuma. What about Tumat Meit? We'll get to that. That has to be a completely different idea of Zot Chukat HaTorah. And obviously what we talk about on that level is the nature of the kapara on that which underlies the entire problem. So, yes, on one level, of course, the Para Aduma is, as Rashi says, let the mother come. That's the tikkun of the Egel. Sounds like a silly little, you know, let the mother come and clean up the mess. So a mashal to a melech had a shivcha. Shivcha brought her kid in. Kid vomits all over the floor. Messes up the palace. Says the melech, it's a call her mother. Call his mother. Let the mother clean up. So too, the egel was the source of all of these problems. Let the paraz, the mother of the egel, come in and clean it all up. But, I mean, what we're really dealing with, obviously, is something deeper than the egel. That's the Yom Kippur issue. But when we deal with kapara, qua para, and you'll note, of course, that all kapara is kippara. Because that's the idea. Somehow or other, this is touching on the nature of the underlying concept of tikkun, cleaning the world. And that tuma, of course, the tumat meit, it's only secondarily sourced in the Egel. It's primarily sourced in Gan Eden. So that what we're really dealing with is the issue of mortality. We're not just talking about chok as how do we deal with a problem. I said with a problem. We're dealing with the problem. So whether it's the question in terms of our Sinai of a more or less local issue of an Egel Azov in which the need, the human need for projection, self-definition, is brought out in a certain childish, local way. I say childish, of course, relative to Gan Eden. We're over there, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, as the Gemara in Avodah Zarah points out, that Ani amarti Elohim atem uvnei ayon kuchem, and I gave you this opportunity for chirut, that's to charut al aluchot, al tikrei charut elach, Chirut, chirut ala chirut. Chirut means chirut mimalach hamavet. Chirut means chirut miyetzarara. Chirut from everything, from forgetting, from all elements of degeneration. But, achen ki Adam, you wish to behave the way Adam behaved? Fine. So you can be tamutu. You drop dead, just like Adam. So it's a reconstruction, even on that level. It's a reconstruction of Gan Eden. And obviously, Paraduma is dealing with paradox on that level. It's not simply the question of Yom HaKippurim and that level of Kapara. And the truth is, we are deeply troubled by the very fact that it says Charut al Aluchot. In a sense, that's the main problem. If you really are living with something that is Charut al Aluchot, then there's nothing much left to do, is there? Well, that's basically what Reish Lakish points out in Masechet Avodah Zarah. Bov nakir tovah l'avotenu sh'asu et ha'egel. She'ilmaleihem anachtu ki'ilu lo banu la'olam, says the Gemara in the end. What would be the point of living? What would we do? What would we achieve? what would be left to achieve? It's all very nice to talk about it in terms of the presence of people. It's much more than the presence of greater people than yourselves. It's the point that, Reuben, if you don't turn off that cigarette, where's the smell coming from? You didn't leave it burning out there or anything? Nah.
Nothing.
Nothing. Is it really a kasher? It really, truly innocent? Oh, then I apologize and give you a bracha that you should never go back to it again. That's great. Sorry. It's not your kids or anything, right? Oh, it's Muncie. The whole place smells of cigarettes. Sorry. I hear you. So, if it's really completely free, and of course in Gan Eden it's exactly the same. Adam HaRishon has exactly the same problem, doesn't he? You're telling me that you've put me into a position of perfection. Well, if I'm in a world of perfection, there isn't really very much for me to do about it, is there? And it's obvious that avodah, by definition, implies imperfection. There's nothing to be oved on if everything works. So the moment you say those words, and I grant ye the freedom of chirut from these luchot, your immediate reaction is, how do we get them broken? And that's what happens in Gan Eden. You know, you're telling me we have the tree that has it all. It's a chayim. Your immediate question is, okay, so how do we bust it? Right? That's, you perceive that the only possible thing to do is to get away from the paradox of chirut. That isn't chirut. If it is chirut, then it's not chirut. Because you've got to be, he's going to, the Adam, obviously, by definition, is going to want out. In order to be a Ben Chorin, you have to be a Ben Chorin. Chorin means there's holes. There's holes that need to be filled. If you've got an absolutely perfect lattice structure, there's nothing left to do. All of the creativity that comes, and literally the technology that comes from biology's use of crystalline structures or our use in electronics of crystalline structures is only because of holes. So to be a Ben Chorin means that the Bria cannot be perfect. Obviously, can't be perfect. And if that's the case, then the fact that the earth makes room in advance for this problem, and that that should be at exactly the same moment that HaKadosh Baruch Hu takes the most joy in Maaseh Bereshit, makes a heck of a lot of sense. Where does the earth make room? Well, it's basically the same time that the earth discovers itself, obviously. Where does the earth discover itself? It discovers itself on the day where HaKadosh Baruch Hu said that the trees should all come out l'mineihem, and said not a word of the same about the Desha'im, and yet the Desha'im are nosei kal v'chomer ba'atzmam, and they say, well, I mean, if trees need to be kept separate, we definitely need to be kept separate, because in the end, everything will just become homogeneous, which, of course, is what the word Desha means. As Rashi says, it just means homogeneous land cover. Well, the Desha'im didn't like being homogeneous land cover. Okay, fine. Yismach Hashem b'masav, says the Gemara in Kulin. Look at this. The world is working itself out. That's lovely. But of course, that goes hand in hand in exactly the same psukim, where HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, let the earth bring forth eitz pri or seh pri. And in the end, it says that the earth brings forth eitz or seh pri. And what does Rashi say there? Lefichach. The earth didn't do what it was supposed to do. It only brought forth eitz oseh pri. So therefore, lefichach, kishin itkalala Adam al chet'o, nitkalala yi al chet'a. So the earth then was mikulalet for the chet of Adam, which must mean that that imperfection built in is something that was absolutely necessary in order for Adam to survive. You cannot have a creation that works and still expect that there's place for a human condition. You cannot expect there to be any chayrut or a ben chorin if you actually are going to be living within an Etz HaChayim. So it would be clear that it would be necessary. I mean, you would think this, certainly the way I would look at it, is that I would tell HaKadosh Baruch Hu, who said, don't tell me you ate from that tree, and you're responsible. Of course I did, and I would do it again. And as it says in the Medrash, which is what Adam Rishon said. So that, there is a fundamental contradiction here. And by the way, that fundamental contradiction is so profound that the Torah actually goes through two completely separate creation narratives that mean opposite things in order to provide for that problem. So the first creation narrative pretends to a world that we're not aware of, in which everything actually worked out the way it was supposed to, and in which God says, you know, let the earth be covered with these green things, you know, and everything grows and it's great. And then it starts the story over again. Of course, it starts the story over again from the point of view of the earth rather than the point of view of creation. Here it becomes B'yom Bara Hashem Elokim Eretz V'Shamayim, which becomes part of the same dualistic issue between Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel in Maaseh Bereshit and Gemara Chagiga. So which one was right? In one story, there's no place for Adam. In the other story, all of a sudden we discover that the above never happened, because Adam ayin la'avodat Adama, and therefore we needed to have the Bria of Adam in order to be able to achieve after Ve'ed Ya'aleh, and then he would be able to be Oved, lo'avdo v'le'shomro, lo haya mishi yakir b'tovatan shel gishamim li'itpalel aliyah, ba'adam itpalel aliyah, now comes the rain, now comes the Ashrat Ashchina, now comes the nature of Avodah, and now comes all the things that, well, which one is the real world? Don't you see that's exactly the same problem? Is it a perfect world that would be defined in an Etz HaChayim fashion, or is it a world that requires work, which is the Etz HaDaat fashion? Obviously, I mean, the way to get to the Etz HaChayim is you have to go through, as the Zohar, so you've got to go through the Etz HaDaat. We want the Derech Etz HaChayim. We don't want the Etz HaChayim immediately, but the Etz HaChayim is Torah. Etz Chayimi, L'machazikim. The Etz HaDaat is entirely a function of what it is that you're going to do. So it's entirely a description of Avodah. All right, and that contradiction is there from the very beginning. And that's why I desire to break away. And of course, it's part of what it is that Mordechai is telling us there. Somehow or other, you have to understand there's no contradiction between those two. Revach v'atzala yamod le'yidim v'kom acher is the Etz HaChayim. That's the way it is. Ato beit avich tovedu is a function of the Etz HaDaat. So now, the question is, of course, what is our relationship to this paradox? Because kapara is going to be the source of getting beyond that thinking. That is where kapara would come from. And it's the reason that para strikes us as being similar. Why is para similar? For a very simple reason. It really and truly is similar. The main problem that we have, I think, as human beings, if you want to translate the issues of the Etz HaChayim and the Etz HaDaat into very simple, down-to-earth questions that every human being actually spends his life worrying about, here is how to express it biologically. Very straightforward. There's two completely different visions of life. There's the vision of life on the level of the biological information of life. There's the vision of life from the point of view of the organisms that are given life by that biological information. So one way of looking at the world is indeed, as Dawkins so beautifully brought out in The Selfish Gene, the information couldn't care less about you. You're carrying information that has programmed you to destroy your life. You're carrying information that has programmed you to die. Because it's good for getting the genetic information out of there to make sure that the old is washed away. You are programmed by simple molecules that code your information to spend your entire life struggling for absolutely no reason to bring children into the world, to support them, to tie yourself down to a family, to do all the things that will make you absolutely miserable because you can't conceive of not doing so. You're programmed by your information to fall in love with people that are rotten for you, but that can get you turned on enough for you to deposit your genes with them, and so on and so forth. Now, one response to that is to be smart enough to say, well, I'll be damned if I'm going to be just a robot of this chemical. I'm going to do things my way. Of course, it's very difficult to get beyond what you are thinking is my way, but which is really just a meta level, the way in which we'll get you. But on the level of these two different ways of experiencing life, one is an information that is kolel the entirety, in a sense, of the human potential. In other words, ultimately, the potential of DNA is there in a way that is called the full potentialities of life in whatever level they ultimately come to be expressed. That's the Eitz HaChaim. It's all there. Now you say, yeah, but what good is it? What it's really about, of course, is me. And me doesn't want to die, and me doesn't want any of those things. Me wants to take what I can out of this. And this, of course, is the Milchemet HaYetzer to a great extent, right? Because I want to do things my way. Why should I? This is something that any human being experiences. The battle to do things your way can lead you into situations that are way over your head, and generally do. Because 3.5 billion years of evolving a code is a heck of a lot smarter than you are going to be. And the additional value of your insights are just immeasurably tiny when it comes to battling the full power of the universe that's behind us. I mean, you don't know the first thing about anything that you're battling. You're a babe in the woods, in the most literal sense. You don't have a chance. That's the bottom line. You don't have a chance. Okay, so what are you doing? So you could see how this is precisely the problem, really and truly is the problem. So that whether you want to embed this in the story of Gan Eden, the story of information, the deepest story of information, because remember that the Yismach Hashem b'Maasav is the story of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's joy, not simply at the fact that Nas'u D'Sha'im Kal V'Chomer Ba'atzman. It's HaKadosh Baruch Hu's joy at the fact that the Desha'im evolved a mechanism for protecting their genetic information. That and only that. It wasn't just the fact that, oh wow, we developed an extra pseudopod. That's not the point. The point is that genetic information was passed around freely in the early stages of evolution, coming to a point in which I will protect my genetic information and not share it is an unbelievable development. And in many levels, it strikes one as being a disaster, a terrible choice. Just as sexual reproduction sounds like a terrible choice. Why in the world should I mess up my ability to clone and take a chance on somebody else's genes? Once again, the statistical reality is such that clearly this is advantageous to the ultimate survivor. We can understand mathematically how that's true. But it certainly doesn't strike us up front as being reasonable. So it's the joy, and the way Rashi puts it is, the Deshaim said, look, if HaKadosh Baruch Hu was interested that the Eitzim, the Ilanot, should be clearly well-defined and delineated. If we're going to come out at the Shaheem, it's just all going to be homogeneous, which, of course, is the opposite of the generation of information, which my separations is all about. So we have exactly this nekuda in which we can produce, that's the tama, it's lav katama pri, is that by not having things work out perfectly, we have what to do. We have what to do in ways that do not demand of us to be what it is that we produce. We can go ahead, produce new things, and remain the same total idiots that we were, so that Mozart doesn't change very much with his music, and we don't change very much with our discoveries, and Avodah is wide open, so that there's this break between our understanding, our Torah, and our Avodah. The nature of Kapara, if it's addressing mortality, it's got to address that very fundamental problem. And remarkably, remember what Rashi says about Lefichach, Kish Nitkalel Adam Al Avono, Nitkalala Hi Al Avona. Now that is an actual template for something that is going to sound awfully familiar. Because when Rivka tells Yaakov, Alai Kilalatcha Bini, so as Chazal tell us, what that means is, well, Mother Earth, after all, took on the chait of Adam HaRishon, so I am your mother, and I will take on the klala of your chait to your father. Just as Mother Parah is going to take on the chait of the ego. Now that is weird. Now we're already getting the mother and child reunion. This is it. So it's somehow this interrelationship over here, specifically, of mother and Ben, Mother Earth and Ben, is truly fundamental in the creation of information. Truly fundamental, this is what we see in the whole story of the Tameitz Ketamapri and the Nuts of the Shai. Truly definitive in the interrelationship of the development of Reishis Yisrael, Shenikra Reishis, in terms of Yaakov and Esav. And somehow, as a paradigm, truly definitive of the nature of Kippara and Kapara and Yom HaKippurim and its relationship to Goral and to all of these other structures, which of course we do on Purim as well as we do on Yom Kippurim. It's Lo Hashem Koveya. It's the Goral, which is Koveya in Yoma. So, boy, that's weird. That is really weird. You know, anybody who's seen Gary Larson's cartoons, you know, I hope you've all seen The Far Side, right? You know, imagine, you know, one of the famous Gary Larson cartoons. There's a cow placidly chewing its cud in front of somebody's door. All of a sudden, up jumps the cow, rings the doorbell, okay? Guy comes running out to find the doorbell, just sees a cow placidly chewing its cud. Now that is absolutely hilarious. A cow placidly chewing its cud. You know, couldn't have rung that doorbell. I mean, it's absolute. You have to be playful. You have to be, you know, forget about the intelligence level. You see, imagine if Gary Larson had put an eagle there instead of a para. It wouldn't have been anywhere near it. It wouldn't have been funny at all, because you actually do expect an eagle to be playful. I mean, that's the part, the whole point, isn't it? That's Ephraim Umanasha, that's Ke'egel Olumad, it's the, you know, the playfulness, the prancing about it. Yeah, I could see an eagle actually ringing a doorbell, you know? But the para, I mean, that's ridiculous. Those completely docile eyes, those acceptance of whatever it is that you do to me. Take all my milk and then turn me into chops. That's worse than the giving tree. So, let's think about the para and the ego on that level. The para represents the aspect of the information. The ego represents the organism. One is a vector. We look at the para as the gene's vector for getting the information out there. So it's looking for ways to put out its genes. When we take a look at the aygo, we think of an aygo sort of as it thinks of itself. Actually, of course, the aygo is the vector, because it's the thing that is going to be used to get its genes around. And yet, it views itself as the tachlit. It views itself as the organism. This is what it's really about. When we burn a parah, what we do is we turn it into pure information. There's no vector there at all. The only thing that's left of a burnt parah, by the way, is that its DNA is still able to be read, remarkably. That's a pretty amazing thing. It was just actually discovered by the NIH just recently, that you can actually read the DNA in the ashes of the parah aduma, not in cremation. Cremation specifically heats a human body to the point that the DNA is destroyed, not in burned bodies. It's a big difference between the two. So in destroying, in carbonizing the parah, what you're doing is essentially taking away any relationship of the information to a particular organism. And you take the parah, and now this is a parah that is as much as possible symbolic of all of the potential that the vector has, as opposed to the information. So it has to be not a nice, docile parah that has been carrying the burden of life on its back. No. Shelo aleha'ol. It's not a mother who doesn't understand that my little boy is sowing his oats because I gave them to him. It's a mother who does understand that. It's a Mother Earth who appreciates the fact that I, Rivka, told you, go screw up royally, and I'll take responsibility. It's I, Earth, have told you, I'll take responsibility. This is not going to be a perfect world. It's going to be a great place for you, Adam. So the moment that you get out of hand, of course, then we come back to mommy and say, now what'd you do that for? I take full responsibility. That's exactly what's going on with the parah aduma. It's amazing. So we reduce it to having no presence at all in the Bria as a functional organism, but reduce it completely to the fact that it's a carrier of information. Taking that, making it part of the overall potential of Bria. And that, of course, is the idea of Mayim Chaim. We talk about Mayim Chaim on this planet as Mayim Chaim, not because it flows, but because it's the source of life, ultimately. And even a primitive person understands that life all shares Mayim. Whether we fully understand that blood is a way of encapsulating the ocean, or whether we just realize that there's so much water that's there and that it's a mashke, whether we come to understand the interrelationship between dam, mizbeach of adama, adam of adama, the nature of the kapara of that dam on the earth, which still has that hemoglobin that we taste in it, in its metal, that we don't put on the mizbeach. No matter the level of our sophistication or lack of sophistication, we understand that what has been done over here is a reduction in the literal sense, oxidation perhaps in more literal sense, but a reduction of a living organism into something that is accessible only through its information potential. And that the individual who has been chote has got to now become aware of the fact that the perception of chet and the understanding of chisaron is linked to that underlying issue of, is this world about me, or is it about the information that leads to me? And of course, to a great extent, that itself is the relationship between Torah and Avodah itself. If Torah really is an Etz Chaimi, what room does it leave for the Avodah? If it's completely full, does that not mean that there would be no makom for chet? Does it not recreate the charut haluchot for me? Does it leave me without any place in the world? Are there alternative realities that allow for chet? What exactly is the place of it? It's there that we're going to have to look for our solutions. So, what this points to is that we're mistaken in dualism. In other words, the way that I've created the problem is unanswerable. There really is, if we view the information that leads to me and me as two different things, it's an unanswerable problem. It really is paradoxical. I mean, how would it be that we relate to the context of that which is us in a way that leaves no room for us? That's crazy. But, I mean, if you think about the nature of the information of DNA, and you'd say, let's forget about the organisms. Let's just talk about the information. What would that mean? What is this information about? It's just a series of letters, as far as I'm concerned, once I decipher its code, and I take, even if I figure out that it codes for amino acids and so on, I still, so, big deal. A pile of soup? It's an awfully complicated way to make soup. It doesn't mean anything. But there's, of course, a much deeper question. It's not simply the issue of, so what would this very complex molecule be about? There's a much deeper question. The much deeper question is, what would be the nature of the information as a concept at all? That's the deeper question. What would lead you to think that there is a concept called information? There is no such concept, you understand, unless there is an ability to decode information and to define it as being information as opposed to everything. That's clear, right? In other words, we're talking about the problem of there being an Eitz HaDaat and an Eitz HaChayim is the problem of, well, if you have all of it, then you don't have anything. But that's very true. If you have everything, then you have nothing. In other words, in a series of infinitely generated random sequences, you have everything. You have every molecule ever coded for, every story in history ever happened, every book that was ever written, somewhere or other, there will be an infinite number of Tanakhs written in your infinite generation of random numbers. True? Your life story will be infinitely repeated. Everything will be infinitely repeated. Remember, infinity is not a very long time. Infinity is infinity. There will be an infinite number of copies of you. Well, except that there won't be any copies because there's no way for us to actually select any particular piece of it. I mean, would I know that the beginning is here and the end is there? Of course not. You know, how exactly would I read the information? There's no eye to read it. So the only thing that makes it information, on the simplest level, the only thing that makes it information is a decoding device. This, of course, was the main recognition of the paradox, the most recent powerful scientific paradox, which was the dual slit experiment that led to quantum mechanics. That's the essence of quantum mechanics. How is it possible that the way that the observer sets up an experiment defines the outcome of the experiment? That's absolutely crazy. It can't, I mean, and no matter what you do, no matter how you try to fool with it, no matter how late in the game you change the setup, it makes absolutely no difference. It always is defined by you. Even if one of this entangled pieces is on the other side of the universe and can't possibly know what you did. That's crazy. That's totally crazy. I mean, there's only one possible way that it isn't crazy. And that is that there aren't two things that are going on. There aren't information and observers. Now, what this means in terms of kapara, what it means in terms of aveda, what it means in terms of the relationship of Torah and aveda, is that, and you'll notice, I mean, the first stage, you know, it's amazing, the first stage to that revolution, the stage that was the last gasp, was a lovely gasp, of classical physics, which of course was relativity, was also a breakdown in the nature of or, a different breakdown. What was that breakdown? How in the heck can you possibly have a wave without a medium? Wave in what? This drove people absolutely crazy. So even though there obviously is nothing there in that medium, we need to postulate a medium. It's the aether somehow. Is there mass? No, there's no mass. Is there friction? No, there's no friction. Well, what is this thing? I don't know, but how can it not be there? If there's waves that are going through it, it's got to be there, right? So basically the Michelson-Morley experiment that knocked out the possibility of there being such a thing was the beginning of a revolution. Was there a satisfactory resolution of that problem? Absolutely not. All that happened was that people said, look, I don't know, but Achilles certainly knows how to run faster than turtles. That's all that happened. Really and truly, that's all that happened. The solution that is begged by the reality of the situation is a solution that accommodates the more developed nature of paradox, which is the question of our own experiential sense of that paradox. And that is the fact that the thing that we're talking about comes into being in what we think is an oscillation between two completely different things. That's what makes it what it is. That's not two different things. It's not that a wave somehow disappears when it's on the x-axis and only appears when I can measure it on its y-axis. That's not the point at all. It's that the wave exists because of the interrelationship of the plus side of the y-axis and the minus side. That's the point, right? Which means that it's not that we need to find an integration between a human being and the information that leads to a human being. It's not that we need to find an integration between the totality of Torah and the ability to do something. Most profoundly, it's not that we need to find some level of integration, relationship, holism between HaKadosh Baruch Hu and ourselves, between creator and created. It's that the coming into being of what we call Bria, or the coming into being of what we call Adam, on a nested level from top to bottom, the coming into being itself is the result of the underlying fact of that paradox. So that there's actually a name for this. There's a scientific name for this, which began in the world of biology and then went on into mathematics, which I don't know if it's such a great name, but it's called autopoiesis. Auto, its own, poiesis, creation. So there's, obviously it's easy to differentiate between autopoietic information and allopoietic information. So let's say you have a factory that's making things. So you send in your computer program for how it's supposed to work, and then it creates something according to the instructions that you send it. That's allopoietic. It's outside orders of creation. You have the way that life functions, in which you take a look at DNA. There's no outside information that's telling it what. It's simply doing itself. So what's the point of that? It's just a closed circle. Well, that may be very true, but that closed circle is what we call life. Does it have any reference to anything outside of itself? Not really, in terms of information. Once it's there, it utilizes those things. It makes, takes in, defines itself in terms of those other things, but the information, as it works itself out, has no access to external dimensions or external issues. It simply is itself creating itself. In a much deeper way, on an existential level, what Chazal point to all the time, which the Torah points to all the time, one of the most beautiful places is in the Gemara about how it is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu wears tefillin. You know, the Gemara asks, so what does it say in HaKadosh Baruch Hu's tefillin? Oh, it says, Mi ka'amcha Yisrael goy echad ba'aretz, instead of Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad. HaKadosh Baruch Hu has to have things about the Shevach of Yisrael? Oh, yes, absolutely. After all, it says, Hashem Mirchai, et Hashem Marta Ayom, Hashem Mirchai Ayom. You were the ones who made me Chativa Achad Bolam. I will make you Chativa Achad Bolam. This is the most bizarre physical orientation that could possibly be there. And yet, we're saying HaKadosh Baruch Hu's tefillin are expressive. And remember, that's like the ultimate relationship. This is the deepest sense of HaKadosh Baruch Hu asking Adam, okay, so what's my name? And Adam saying, well, your name is God. Okay, so that's who I'll be. Zeshmi Olam, the shame that Adam HaRishon gave me. That's my name. Listen to the Haftarah of the Parashat Parah. Because there's a theme here that is being brought out, and it isn't clear. So, after saying what a bunch of stinkers we are, you know, so Yechezkel says that HaKadosh Baruch Hu finally decides, look, can't put up with this any longer. We can't wait for these guys to fix anything. And so, Ve'echmol al Shem Kodshi, Asher Chiluluhu Beit Yisrael Bagunim Asher Ba'u Shama. So, I have to have Rachamim on my poor name. I mean, like, isn't it up to you, sort of? I mean, if you don't have to worry about your name if you're not worried about it. Well, what's my name going to feel like? It's a very strange pasuk. All right. So, Lokein Emor Beit Yisrael. Ko Amar Hashem Lokim. I just want you to know, Lo Lamanchem Ani Oseh Beit Yisrael. Kim L'Shem Kodshi. I'm doing all of this for Shem Kodshi. Because you guys, Chilaltem Baguyim Asher Batem Shama. So I'm going to come along with Kiddushti et Shmi Hagadolam Chulal Bagoyim Asher Chilaltem Betocham V'yadu Hagoyim Kani Hashem Nu Hashem Elokim. All of the Goyim are going to know how great my shame is. Okay, what's going to be? Why do we read this here? Well, because I'm going to gather you together V'zarakti Alechem Mayim Torim, which of course is what we're talking about here, U'taratem Mikol Tumotechem U'mikol Gilulechem ונתתי לכם לב חדש, ואסירות את לב האבן מבשרכם, נתתי לכם לב בשר, ותרוכי אתן בקרבכם, ועשיתי את אשר בחוקי תלכו. Wow. Is that good? I mean, what would be the point of ועשיתי אשר בחוקי תלכו? So then what's the point? If you're doing it, are you doing it or we're doing it? If you're doing it, it's not much of a Kiddush Hashem. I thought Kiddush Hashem consists of are doing the right thing. I mean, obviously you can do whatever you want. If it's your name, do what you want. But what does it prove about anything? All right, I don't know. That's what it says. V'yishavtem ba'aretz, v'oshati etchem ikotumotechem. Everything's going to be great. U'schartem et darcheichem ha'raim. But I want you to remember what a bunch of stinkers you are. Lo l'manchem ani yoseh. I mean, you said that already. Well, I'm overheated. Got to be some meaning to the repetition. Lo lamanchem ani yosenu Hashem Elokim yivadalechem. What's the yivadalechem? That is going to become abundantly clear. How is that going to become abundantly clear? Yeah, it's only clear because you said so in the beginning. So how will it be yivadalechem through the course of this process? My suggestion is that the process is the Yivadalachem. And that the meaning of Lo Lamanchem Ani Oseh is not the way people take it. Namely, you are a bunch of stinkers and I wouldn't do this for you, but my name is suffering and therefore I will do it for my name. because that doesn't even make any sense. What it means is exactly what we've been saying. The problem that has led to this situation of your being the way you are, of having grown into a Lev HaEven, of not having Ruchi B'Kirbachem, is a result of your thinking that I do things for you. That was the beginning of the whole problem, wasn't it? Wasn't that the problem in the Eitz Hadaat? Oh, well, you did this. It's Aisha Shenatata Imadi. I don't want the woman you gave me, but she's the best woman. I don't care. You gave her to me. I'll find my own woman. That's the meaning of the Achen Ki Adam Tumutun in the Gemara in Avodah Zarah. You gave me the Torah. Kafalem Archa Gigit. Well, what do you mean, Kafalem? Kafalem, because you know it's the only possible choice. I know. But that's exactly why I don't want it, because it's the only possible choice. Who wants the only possible choice? I want to live in fantasy. Can you imagine the hell of living with the only possible choice just because it's right? But all of that comes because of a basic dualism in which you believe that there is a God that does things for you. So when HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, you know, this has been the problem all along, I never do anything for you. Ever. It's never about that. Why would I want to do anything for you? You're all a bunch of stinkers. It's ridiculous for me to do anything for you. So the whole process consists of, and always has consisted of, one thing. Shmi HaGadol. So you're saying, what is this Shmi HaGadol jazz? I mean, is it you? No, no. I said, I'm going to do this for Shmi HaGadol. Of course, it's not me, Shlemiel. It's Shmi HaGadol. Okay, so who exactly is Shmi HaGadol? So now here is where we need to understand a enigmatic Rambam that nobody explains. There's attempts to explain it, nobody explains. The Rambam that we've spoken about, and it's the opening Rambam. Yisod ha-yisodot ve'amud ha-chochmot kula leida. Leida. Interesting. Yivada lachem. Okay. Leida. She'yesham matzri rishon. Now, in English, that sounds perfectly correct. Let us translate the words. Yesh sham, there is, matzri rishon, prime existence. The only problem is that in Hebrew, there's no such construct as there is. Remarkably, even in making a logical proposition, in English, you can only say there is. In order to get away from the word there, you have to use mathematics. So you have a symbol for that idea of is. But if you want to speak out a logical proposition, you're going to have to say there is in English. Of course, in Hebrew, you'd never say there is, where is. In Hebrew, there is an absurd dimensional constraint which cannot appear. You say yesh. So the Rambam is talking about the ultimately non-dimensionally constrained concept that he's trying to give us, which he spends so many pages saying, oh, don't think there are any dimensional constraints, but he starts by saying there is.
He says the sham is...
What?
He favors that term.
Yes, yes, and there's a very good reason for favoring that term. The reason for favoring that term, the Sun and Mepharshim actually view it as a pulling in from the Arabic, believe it or not. Just like saying it was English he was thinking in, you know, translating it into Hebrew. The reason that he favors the term is precisely because the word yesh could be abstracted. Yesham cannot be abstracted, and that's the reason that sham relates to shame. The nature of shame is immanence. The nature of sham is immanence. If you're going to tell me that there's yesh matzri rishon, then that means its existence is irrelevant to my vision of dimensionality, which would mean that we're talking about some type of idea, which is not what we're talking about. We have no access to the idea that people call God. That doesn't exist for us. We have access only to the Creator. The Creator cannot be confused, of course, with the philosophical notion of Matzoi Rishon, because the Matzoi of the Matzoi Rishon is accessible only through our experience of existence. And therefore, that is the deepest Sham that could ever be. And there's no way to ever avoid that. Existence is where it begins, but existence is defined by the experience of existence. This is a terrible problem, if you're thinking dualistically. If you recognize that Yesham is the shame, then there's no problem at all, because then it's exactly true that in an autopoietic universe, the only sense of existence that will ever emerge is precisely this one, the one in which the Da'aga L'Shmi HaGadol is the only possible way in which anything would ever get done, because it's all that you care about. The Shmi HaGadol is us. It's the information of the Yesham instead of the existence of a Yesham, you see. So in the sense of information, no observer, no God. You want a creator, you need a created. That's Bereshit Bara Elokim. Exactly. As the Gemara says, they had to change because the Greeks would think that Elohim is the name of some secondary god, and they would read it, Bereshit created Elohim. But of course, that's exactly what it says, and it's true. Bereshit really does create the entire notion of Elohim, except not in the Greek sense, which implies all types of funny kind of things of, you know, pre-existing materials or non-materials or ideas or whatever. But in the deepest sense of the Bishvil Reshis, that everything that we have, every expression of ourselves, every ability to act within the universe, is defined by a unity, not an integration, not something that's holistic, not an emergent idea called Shechina, but an actual part of the creation itself. And that's the Atama Situni Chativa Achat. In this sense, the nature of Avoda goes all the way back to Adam HaRishon's first moment, in which all of the animals, as the Medrash tells us, come to bow down to Adam. After all, here is the guy that gives information a good name. The best name. Yep. So here is the guy, so therefore he must be God. So they all bow down to Adam, just like in the Lion King, right? It's beautiful. Here we hold up the little Adam, you can just see it. And everything is bowing down to that little Adam. It's gorgeous, just gorgeous. So Adam says, wait a minute. How about if I show you Misha Asarat HaOlam, Misha Amar? How about if I show you that? So he brings them all and introduces them, which of course is Korbanot, which is why the Korbanot can only be Beima, not Chaya. For Avodah Zarah, the Chaya is the nicest. I mean, you bring God a lion, you know. What do you gotta bring him a sheep? I mean, that is cheap old stuff. Stuff you raise, you get, like, that's like bringing him lox from a salmon farm. You know, you want to have lox. I mean, for heaven's sakes, it's got to be Norwegian free, right? Well, you think at least you're putting Korbanot on the Mizbeach. I mean, come on. Get something really, really, I mean, a bear, a lion, I mean, at least a deer, but not farm-fed animals. Because that's the whole idea, is that Behemah only comes into existence in terms of the relationship with Adam. That is easy to understand. There simply ain't no such animal in my Sebereshis. HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't bring Behemot to Adam. He brings him all of the Chayot, yes, but no behemot. All of a sudden, Adam gives them names. And what does he name? He names all of the behemot and all of the birds and also all of the chayot that are now relegated to the bottom of a list because they only came into being at that moment because they are a function of human language, in the deepest sense of human language. That means that Avodah is totally, that's Bishvil Yisrael Shenikra Reshit. Bishvil Truma Shenigoreshet. The entire nature of everything that we do is creative. So to think that things need to be missing to be creative, or it's the very totality of potentiality that allows in the organism in which that information now becomes, what deeper creativity could there be? So the most creative thing in the world is avodah, of course. And of course it's directly and totally defined by the depth of access that you have to the pool of its potential. It doesn't have to be a contradiction, unless you're a child, which is the way we're born, which is the way the universe is born, which is the way Maisa Bereishis proceeds. But it's not the way that it is. It's the way of its process. And so the interrelationship between being and becoming is precisely the same thing. How we perceive being, how we perceive becoming. It's a horror, that contradiction to us. It's an absolute horror. We hate the thought of actually being, because we relate that to some type of Christian heaven with flitting around on little wings with halos on our head. Blah! That is totally boring. That's how we view Gan Eden. What a boring existence. But on the other hand, we absolutely detest becoming, because then we never are anything. Well, how do you have them both? This is a series of nested issues that goes through all of my separations, all of human experience. So that what Parashat Parah ultimately addresses is the true meaning of Chirut al Aluchot. It brings you from the story of the probabilities, the potentialities, to not Atu Beit Avich Tovedu, because you weren't the Revach Vatzalah Mimakom Acher, but because you had a chance to create and didn't. And that world disappeared. And that's the deepest Tovedu, the deepest loss, is a disappearing universe. The deepest pain that we suffer as human beings is knowing that there was an opportunity that we missed. That kills us. That is hell. Truly, that is hell. That is Ganem. To look back on your life and to say, oh my God, what an ass. How did I not? Oh, what I realized that could have been worth. Oh no. And not to have used it. That is truly hell. You don't need any other hell. It's the most horrific sense of existential loss. So the elements of avodah is exactly that. That's olam haba. That's nitzchiyut. That's everything. And the more one is aware of that potential and can actualize, it's not a question of actualize the way they used to look at it in the Middle Ages, actualizes, you know. Minha kaya chela payal, as if these are two different worlds and so on. It's in the nature of being and information itself that we're talking about. We're talking about creation on exactly the same level as the creation of the world. And that's the deepest meaning of Ilmale Hachet Hayut Tzadikim Yoshvim Uborim Olamot. It doesn't mean if only we hadn't sinned, we could have been on a madriga to create worlds. It's that if our point of view would not be the point of view of Chet, then everything that we would be doing would be creating worlds. Because that's what it truly is. Instead, it becomes a way to do it my way, while taking into consideration the big boss. Horrific. No way out of that type of Christian religious viewpoint, as long as you're going to continue to look at the world dualistically in that fashion. You'll go directly from there to the nature of a world that appears to be completely and totally defined by Chok, which of course is Parashat HaChodesh, and recognize that when it comes to the definition of what our experience of time is, it's totally different from the way that we would define it astronomically, that the relationship that we have to God is a function of Kriya. It's the same as Kriyat Shemot. It's the Mikra'e Kodesh. It's Adam's definition. It's Atem. It's Lachem. It's yours. Afilu mutaim. Afilu mezidim. Get it wrong. Do it your way. Understand that it's the entire structure that matters. The way in which you're going to apply it locally is always going to be a remarkable moment, which is worth more, far more, l'shamayim, than anything that could have been defined in some type of mathematical fashion. And of course, that's the reason that we use the moon. The moon is out of its cotton picking mind, as the Gemara refers to, right? We don't have orbits of moons because it's just way too complex to pretend the old Newtonian trick that gravity is in the center of something. When it comes to the moon-earth system, you can pretend that when it comes to the sun-earth. Because, I mean, it's ridiculous. The center of gravity of the sun and earth is, for all intents and purposes, the center of the sun. But the center of gravity between the moon and the earth is horrific. It's way out of center. So because of that, here we are thousands of years later, and nobody has developed an algorithm that can give you the real molad. You can come close. Was there ever a Median Molad that actually happened? Probably not. If Rabbi Gamliel sits down and suddenly looks up the sky and says, "What the hell are you doing here?" Takes a rock and starts throwing it out. Would you go cover yourself? You're not supposed to be there tonight. Yeah, we view that as being very funny, but it's a very profound interrelationship of Adam's experience of time with the mathematics of time. Will you please go away? No, and the fact that the Gemara can make that into so much the human experience that it will define menses, you understand? We're talking about the moon, really a moon-defined phenomena. And here the human sense of, well, we told everybody it's Rosh Chodesh. Oh my God, I'm supposed to get my period today. But wait a minute, it isn't really. That has nothing to do with it. And la halakha, that's the fact. That's crazy. So it's profoundly a sense of experience. We go from Purim to Pesach through those stages because they're the only way in which you can translate a sense of avdut, of incompletion, to a sense of complete ability to act without demanding chet. Instead of just doing things, we end up creating things. Instead of experiencing ourselves as just vectors of a massive information in which we're doing what we're programmed to do, we suddenly uncover that that program is a program for creators, not a program for robots. And that there's no contradiction between that. Creators have to have a program that allows creating. And that's the Rebbe. That's great. There's nothing that more allows you to create than to know that that is the nature of reality. And so I offer you my suggestions that it's an awfully happy time, despite the fact that it's experienced with a tremendous amount of dissonance and confusion, and that in reality, the nature of Cheiros is a very, very complex interrelatedness that we have with what history means. All of the parot, by the way, are called by the individual's name who made them. And every Yom Kippur, you don't simply mitaher the Kohen Gadol. You zorek alav mikol para. You use every para that was ever made. Because after all, there weren't very many in the entire history of the world, including the one made by Mashiach, there's only 10. So there's been 9 so far, 7 up to the period where, and that's how it worked out, Shiva Yamim, there was the Sreifa, you know, before the Sreifat HaParah, so you were able to use every one that there was. Or before walking in on Yom HaKippur, you were able to use every parah that was. But that's because even the parah itself, which is ostensibly discussing something which goes beyond the entire issue of history or the moment, is itself, on a meta level, a creation of history. Here's the parasha sa Moshe, here's the parasha sa Ezra, And each and every one of those times was so independently creative that every single one of them needs to be part. It's the history of Parah, not just the fact of Parah, that brings out so beautifully the nature of human history, individual narrative, and the relation of narrative to history. And in the end, the relationship of the ultimate narrative, which is the Adam Ayin La'avodat Adama, Ad Sheba Adam, and communicate it. So talk. So tell me what the information is. Don't you know? Stop being a fool. It says that beautiful, that beautiful diary, you know. I only keep these notes so for God to read. Don't you think God already knows? Oh, he knows, but he doesn't know this version of it. And that is so much the ultimate statement of human creativity, of the absolute uniqueness of every human experience, that it is literally the creation of a world that we should be zochah to for ultimate chirut and for the final para. So Chag Kasher V'Sameach to everybody. Again, I thank you so much. This time I can thank our host, Rabbi Yehuda, who put together such a beautiful, beautiful Suda and such Achnasat Orchim with about 3 hours of notice, as usual. And we're deeply appreciative. And just imagine if you'd had a full day, you know, what we really would have had. So that potential, you know. That potential, we're also...
Mike said if he would have known Thursday, he would have been here.
Mike Mills?
Yeah.
Really? That's nice.
What are you making? Because what are you calling me for today? So I just sent out
The thing, I don't send out anyone outside of the New York area, because it's going to cost them so much money to come. It's crazy.
It costs them more not to come.
I suppose. It's true.
And the Vaybarachota Vayomer Lahim Elohim, even in the first Pirik.
Thanks for the patience.
It's so amazing in terms of this, because what he's saying is, he's saying it has to be a bracha first of all, because it's opening it up to creation, which explains the Naaseh Adam in that situation, which opens it up to that creation. It's the only discussion of let's see what we do. But to say Vaybarachot Elohim V'Kivshuha, essentially it's saying there is no world without your creation. And then all I can say is a bracha to it. In other words, I can't, it's not even a direct thing. It's a mvarech that you should be out, go out and face.
That this is unfortunately a tiny portion of almost here, the interrelationship of all of the various issues according to all of the various issues.
Oh, my God.
Which would have taken hours. I've decided at the last minute that it's crazy.
So this is just
and I'll just do para. Wow. But all of these things are actually part of like the whole discussion.
Because we were killed.
So Bezrat Hashem, I hope to do it when I get home.
I'd love to. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, so you'll come with me and we'll do it together.
I'm heading after Pesach.
Right, we have to before Pesach.
All sense.
You're doomed to repeat it if you're not the.
That's cute. It's cute, Remnant.
Can we also
wait,
say,
I need to give it this style. Yeah. Sorry. I've been sitting here this whole time. I know. I can't believe you're leaving.
One nice thing about living here.
Both the Das and.
Yes, I forgot.
And the Chaim, no?
Yeah.
I forgot
the Seichel gun has to be the same.
It's in the
right.
I didn't say it wrong.
No. I was just asking what you were saying.
Of course. I always hate it when I look to the notes.
No, it was mashma.
Right now, before we lose a minion.